was kind of saying that, like, you know, Waterloo and Laurier, they're kind of cool with each other. And frankly, I'm not cool with that. I want Laurier and Waterloo to hate each other a little bit more. Hello and welcome to At the 55, your home for OUA football. Me and Tom are back on the mics with episode 7 of the Exit Meeting series. Today, being the day before Valentine's Day, it seems so appropriate to go to one of my loves in my life, which is the Ottawa GGs. But before we can get into all things Garnet and Gray, I just have to say, Tom, how the heck are you doing, my friend?
I am doing well, my friend. You know, before we really got into these exit meetings, we started talking about some of the guests that we would potentially have on the show and that. And obviously for Mac and Guelph, we decided that it was just going to be the two of us because it's our own backyard. We did the same thing with the GGs because it is Zach's first love. Well, second love now that he is a Guelph Griffin once again. But the GGs are up there with some of your most favorite on all of sports.
They really are. And I think I've said it on a pod or two before. It's almost one of those things that's just become a bit like that I just dive into. But it's been now what? It's the year's 2024. Like, we're coming on close to 5 full years or 6 years of doing this podcast. And there has just been some really entertaining teams with this Ottawa GG program. And I think of recent years too, and obviously it's all about the players and we'll talk about them thoroughly, but I think in just this recent span with Coach Belfay at the helm, there's just a certain like gravitas to the program that he exudes that is just like, yeah, you know what, like, the GGs are kind of cool in my books, but you know what, I got love for all these OUA teams across the board. Tom, I feel like the place we have to start with this conversation, you know, I guess we can do a little bit of the background. Of course, this team, that's where we should start with the conversation. And, you know, in case you forgot, Ottawa goes 4-4 this year. They sneak out the Panda with the 55-yard field goal. Campbell Fair, just, you know, shout out to him for always being on brand for our sake. They lose a tight game to Queens in the end of the regular season at Richardson. They go back there the week after to take them on in the quarterfinals, play them tight again. I did the math just in my head. I think Queens and Ottawa have played like 7 times in the last 3 years. Mm-hmm. Ottawa plays Laurier really close midseason. They falter to Western, you know, pretty substantially. A tight game against Windsor. So they did, I think, amongst all the teams, you know, as far as revisiting our preseason tiers, yeah, I think we had them a little higher, and obviously we'll get into the injury component for this team. But when you look at just how they did against the top dogs in this league, I feel like Ottawa was pretty close to how, aside from us thinking Western was going to be really good and Laurier was going to be really good, mm-hmm. And York not so good. I feel like Ottawa, even despite major injuries, I should say, performed how we thought they would.
I think so. Yeah. With everything that we saw going into this season, I think we saw Ottawa at that middle of the pack, maybe mid to high end of the OUA. And that's kind of where they finished. Obviously 4-4, they're right dead at 500. But Ottawa is just one of these teams, and it extends back even to when you and I were playing, that they are always competitive no matter who they play. It's very rare for an Ottawa team to just get outright blown out, even against some of the top talent in the OUA. And I think you saw that in this year, even, you know, the unbelievable battles that we have seen between Ottawa and the Windsor Lancers as well, going back to back. Windsor sneaks away with this one, 42-31. And even the biggest margin of, I guess, loss here is to the Western Mustangs. They win 50-17. And it's still, there's areas in that game where things are competitive and you're looking back at things and, you know, the Laurier Golden Hawks 38-30. And you and I are looking at each other during that game being like, is Ottawa going to pull this out? Everybody had Laurier pick for this one. And obviously Laurier kind of does their thing, but this is a very, I wouldn't sleep on these Ottawa GGs. Let's just say that. There's a lot of talent, and they dealt with a whole ton of injuries, but they still look pretty good throughout everything, despite it all.
Yeah, and I think in our tiers, there was really two major components that changed the temperature in the room in terms of our assessment of it. One was there was, and just to be the broken record on this topic that I am, the COVID piece of it all makes all things confusing with this, but there seemed to be the possibility that J.P. Simmonkinda could return.
Mm-hmm.
That seemed to be the one thing. Now, having said that, I don't think anyone thought Amilcar Polk, as successful as he was being the number two running back to J.P. Simmonkinda, was going to become one of the top rushers in the whole province mm-hmm. this year. We knew that, but then on the flip side of that, we knew James Peter was gone, but did we think that Max Garbonneau, a guy who was, again, playing alongside the almost DPOY of 2022, was going to turn into the DPOY of 2023?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we saw that jump. And then you have the Ben Merrickle injury. You have our guy Harner Dhaliwal go down. All these pieces that I think the potential of this team going into the year had that upper limit of, like, maybe you're nipping on the heels of the Laurier, you know, depending on how, I'm trying to remember if we did A1, A2 type deal. But I think that's where we landed. And then to your point, it's a great point where, but they just still do what Ottawa seems to do year in after year, which is just be competitive and just have that mentality that they're going to be in games. They're going to make things uncomfortable. Mentioned Ben Merrickle's name. And this is initially where I was going to go with it before realizing we should probably just go over the numbers of like how they did. Because we've talked about this quarterback room for pretty much all season long, even going back to when Ryan Lacandro transferred from Queens there
mm-hmm.
and just the added presence, another quality starting quarterback in the league. But you have Ben Merrickle, of course, going down. Gosh, I mean, first quarter, but it might have been first drive. We're talking like Aaron Rodgers on the Jets type of like situation. Ryan Lacandro steps in. And if you don't remember Ryan Lacandro pre this Ottawa season, he's competing with James Keenan, the former quarterback at Queens before Alex Vreeken took over mm-hmm. back in 2018, 2019. And it's really between the two of them. And James Keenan was an excellent quarterback for Queens during that time. Lacandro steps in. He goes down. And then we get the insurgence of one Josh Jansen coming in like a bat out of hell. His first start, like the run he had to go on was was Western his first game?
Yep.
He takes on the Western Mustangs in his first start in OUA action, picks up the win the following week in the Panda, puts up that uber competitive game against Laurier, and just ends up giving them this, you know, on top of this incredible running game, this viability in the passing game that we thought was all for naught.
Mm-hmm.
And then you throw in the fact that Matt Mahler was a former quarterback competing with Ben Merrickle before Merrickle won the job, and Mahler is listed as just an athlete on the roster. But the quarterback talent has to be one of the prime things that is on all GG fans' minds right now. Where do we go with this conversation? Like when we think about these guys, they all have potential to be back. You mentioned some exciting news about Ben Merrickle. What's this conversation about really when we're talking about these quarterbacks?
Well, you have to start looking at the potential that all of these guys have. Ben Merrickle has been invited to the CFL Combine as well, whether that's just a throw or not, he is still going there. And I think that's a testament to him and to what his potential is. Ben Merrickle, entering into this season, was a fourth year. He only played in one game, so he technically still has this 1 year left, along with his fifth year. So he can definitely come back at least for one, maybe even two, depending on how he's feeling. Josh Jansen is only a second-year player, and I believe Ryan Lacandro is only a third-year player. So you've got a couple young guys who are ready and chomping at Ben Merrickle's heels here to try to get things going. But like you mentioned, Josh Jansen, and he gets thrown into the fire with Western. Just for his first three games, listen to this. He goes up against Western. He finishes 19 for 24, 213 yards, and a pick. Then the next week, he goes up against Carlton, and they win the Panda. He goes 18 for 28, 251 yards, two touchdowns, and two picks. And then he goes up against Laurier. And Laurier is one of the best defenses in this conference in this past year. And Laurier, just as an overall team, absolutely unbelievable. Josh Jansen goes 20 for 27, 233 yards, two touchdowns, zero picks. Arguably doing even better than his counterpart in Taylor Elgersma, who goes 22 for 32, 257, one touchdown and one pick. So this kid being completely thrown into the fire, starting off with Western, playing in the Panda game with over 20,000 people watching you, and then going up against the Laurier team, who is very damn good, comes out of it, and you and I are looking like, is this guy a top five quarterback in the OUA as the third string backup in this Ottawa GG's team, which is an insane stat to think about? And now you start looking into this season, you go, Ben Maracle, when he is healthy, is one of the best quarterbacks for sure. I think that just using this past year as an example, I don't know what happens in practice and the overall, whatever. I would say that Josh Jansen is now the second guy in line, with Ryan LeCandro being potentially the third. Do you, as a coaching staff, start to look at your future and saying, do we try and look at Ben Maracle and have him be our guy, have him come back as the veteran? Or do we look at Josh Jansen and potentially go to the young kid with the hot arm, who seems to be have a pretty good control of the offense? Now, he's got some fantastic receivers to throw to in Malafon, Gendron, and those guys, but he seemed to have a pretty good chemistry with them. And if he's got a full training camp and a full season to work with these guys in the offseason and get things going here, is his ceiling higher than Ben Maracle's? And that, it seems like a damn near impossible question to kind of answer, because it's Ben Maracle. It's not just some scrub off the streets. It's freaking Ben Maracle. Like, this is a top tier quarterback.
Yeah. And just quickly, again, the thing I love about the fact that you're saying that, and I totally agree, is that Maracle's career didn't start like that. He grew into this position over time and earning all that. You know, it's reflecting the conversation we had about U of T in some ways, about with Scott Barnett and with Kinsale Phillip. And of course, it seems like the news now is that they are going to go to Barnett, the quarterback, with Phillip, I guess, switching to the defensive side of the ball there. But as far as I know, if you do want to go that route of saying, well, okay, you know, maybe we have more years to develop the offense around Josh Jansen, you look at some of the talent, and you know, you have obviously Amilcar Polk, who will be gone after this, or like who is going to be gone now, but then you have a young guy, Charles Asselin, Soleiman Kamara in the backfield, who both, I mean, Charles Asselin's had 2 years really going on strong, Kamara in his first year, and then those wrecks that you mentioned, another guy in Kerwin Geist being just a really good weapon for them. You could say, like, well, you know what, and with the exception of Malafon and Geist, who are fourth years, but you think might be coming back, you know, you get a lot of youth in that receiving core and just that skill position as a whole to work with him. So it's super tough. And again, like, I don't even know the status of Maracle's injury, but having said that, the news you had mentioned to me is obviously lends itself to assuming that he's perfectly fine to be throwing the ball around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If he's going to the CFL combine to throw, I would have to assume that he's back, he's healthy, he's ready to go. And not just healthy, but he's ready to be in somewhat of, you know, I don't want to say game shape, because obviously he's not getting a rush against them. But if you're throwing in the CFL combine, you're showcasing your arm talent to not only scouts, but you're also making sure that your receivers look good and everything else. So you got to be full go. And I assume that Maracle is full go. He's back to it. And the other thing as well, you know, we talked about he built up into getting to where he is now. He goes down against Waterloo in, you know, very early on. He starts that game 4 for 4 with a touchdown pass. And we're looking around going, oh shit, Ottawa looks pretty damn good. And now obviously he goes down or whatever, but like, is that just a small snippet of what could have been? And if you're Ben Maracle, and we know the kind of competitor this dude is, he's not coming back to sit on the bench. He's coming back to claim his old spot and say, thanks for keeping it warm for me, Josh. I'm coming back. I'm the guy. So I think one of the most exciting atmospheres in all of youth sports is going to be that quarterback competition with the GGs this year.
Yeah. And, you know, the thing that I think also lend itself on top of, I don't think we realized when you mentioned that 4-4, that like, could that possibly be where his potential's at right now? But of course, it's aided always by the support you have around you, right? And the year he had when, you know, when JP Simonkin is running the ball for you, you know, that elevates everyone by such a magnitude, right? Quarterback especially. But then what was so interesting going into this year is that while Simonkin was a bit of a, not a surprise when he didn't come back, it was kind of like a, oh, he, is there a chance he comes back? Maybe, maybe not. But was that, like, in addition to some of those great skill position guys that you had mentioned, is that, and I just don't know if we ever dug in enough or reached out to the people we needed to find out, but you have a guy in Willie Pierre Dembongi who just didn't come back. And you have a guy in Rodney Estimate, like another receiver who just didn't come back. And again, just, you know, going back to whether it's the Coach Belfay aspect of this whole thing or something even greater than just Coach Belfay himself with this GG program, where they just continued and probably say they took a step back from where they were in 2022, but still, all things considered, were very formidable this year, especially when you look at, hey, they were competing pretty much with all the top teams and, you know, all these injuries and such. But a name, and this will help us start to talk about the defense, because the defense is one of the most exciting components of this team from what we've been seeing the last couple of years, even though it's the proverbial like eye test over stats, because the stats really don't do justice to just like how much fun it is to watch this defense. Was when we got word that a certain twin who started his career playing football in the Ottawa region, but for the crosstown rivals in the Carleton Ravens, was switching from the, you know, fear of the conspiracy side of things to whatever the Garnet and Gray hashtag is for the GGs. That, of course, being Denny Ferdinand. As a quick reminder, of course, twin brother, I'm assuming they're twins. They have to be twins. Maybe they're not twins. Oh, well, brother, twin or otherwise, of all-Canadian wide receiver Kasim Ferdinand, who was playing DB. I can't even recall specifically where he was for Carleton in that defensive secondary, and also just an absolute phenom returning kicks. We don't see him a snap for the Carleton Ravens this year, and then all of a sudden, turns out he's going to be playing for the Ottawa GGs. That's certainly something to behold, because if he is where he left off and just a little more physically mature and studying film wherever he's at, adding into some of these DBs that they have, and we'll go through those names. And then, I mean, of course, like what he can do as a returner is something that's really special for this team, because he, in only 1 year of OUA action, was very impressive. And from what we've seen for Kasim, I think it's fair to assume that Denny wouldn't just be a flash in the pan, given Kasim's gotten just better and better.
Most definitely. And it seems like anytime a Ferdinand touches the ball, special things happen, whether in the Ottawa region, whether it's for these GGs or for the Carleton Ravens. Now, I assume that Denny is going to be just as prevalent as what we saw in Carleton, if not getting even better. It is also worth noting that the youngest brother, Justin Ferdinand, is also going to the Ottawa GGs as well. So there will be two Ferdinand brothers. The entire Ferdinand family does have a possibility of playing in the Panda game with two brothers against one, which that adds another layer into the Panda, which is already as high as it could possibly get for that Ottawa region. But yes, Denny Ferdinand and the younger brother, Justin Ferdinand, also going to Ottawa is a big get for these GGs as well, along with the list of great DBs that this team has.
And, you know, let's get into some of those names, because obviously part of what we've been doing with these podcasts, it's looking at how the last year went, any news and notes like what Tom was just mentioning about the Ferdinands, and then taking a way too early perspective, not just into next year, but to think about things like combines and like the draft. And, you know, off the jump, seeing a guy like Kevin Victome, one of like the premier cornerbacks in the OUA, being a fifth-year guy, I think he's going to be someone we talk about come the combine, 100%. You have our guy in Harner Dhaliwal, who missed most of this year for injury. Third-year guy, I think pretty safe that if he's back and healthy, we'll see him back in the Garnet and Gray. Christopher Cyril, fourth-year guy. Don't know if he's someone we're going to see at the draft, but a veteran guy in that secondary. You have the brothers Cumberbatch, Eric and Patrick, both, unless something happens as far as transferring or whatever, expect to see him back. Eli Cruikshank, third-year guy, missed a lot of this year due to injury. Hopefully he's back. And then Tolu Ahmed, guy who started his career at U of T, transferred to Ottawa, listed as fourth-year eligibility. Maybe he's getting a sniff come the draft. But all those guys just being so stellar at what they do. But of course, and not to speed past talking about any of those guys in specific, but what's made the defense so spectacular is that for the last 5 years, these teams have revolved around just outstanding linebacking play. Of course, this year specifically in Max Carbonneau, and then years past with Carbonneau, but James Peter and a guy like Emmanuel Aboyegyan in the mix as well. I mean, it's one of those things, Tom, where like we watch this team week after week, and then I go to see the stats, and they're fairly middling when you rank just like, oh, like Queens and Windsor and Laurier went, you know, in Western as far as points given up and all these things. And I'm just like, I don't care. This Gigi's defense is amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Adding Ferdinand to that mix is just crazy.
We talked about it so much. This Gigi defense, we really think was one of the best, even if they don't necessarily have the stats to really back that up. We saw some really outstanding play, especially from this defensive secondary and the linebackers. Like Max Carbonneau was one of the best linebacking displays that I had ever seen. And you and I talked about it going into this season. How do you replace a guy like James Peter? Well, you have Max Carbonneau, who actually shows up with the President's Award trophy when we thought and made multiple mistakes because we thought it was so sure that James Peter was going to win that one a couple of years ago. But when you take a look at what Max was able to do and the unbelievable play that we saw from him as that middle linebacker, you start to look at the depth that this defense has, and you really start looking around exactly like you kind of went through there with all of the DBs that are there and the linebacking play. Now, once again, they're in the same situation where you have to replace your President's Trophy winner in Max Carbonneau, and how they come up with that is definitely going to be the biggest question mark here. But really, like, this defense, in my opinion, is just one good pass rusher away from being one of the best in the OUA. I think that's the thing that we didn't see consistently enough for them. Not to take anything away from their defensive line, because their D-line was fantastic as well, don't get me wrong, but we just didn't see that consistent pass rush that really forced quarterbacks into a rough situation. And I think if they have that a little bit more, you know, suddenly we're starting to take a look at that Laurier game or, you know, some of the other close games that we see here, getting people pressured and getting them out of their comfort zone and seeing what can happen. So that's the one thing that I think this defense was missing, is that consistent pass rush, but the secondary play was second to none.
No, absolutely. And the pass rush piece, obviously a huge part, especially like when you look at some of these quarterbacks. And I was going through the box score of that Laurier game, and it really is so impressive. And whether it's Laurier with Elgersma, whether it's Vreeken at Queens, whether it's you know, even Hillock, who's not the most fleet of foot, but he's a big dude. He moves really well in the pocket, you know, with your guy Mac, you know, with just all these young quarterbacks like Lefebvre that are so good now. And Nate talked about it, where it's like just the level of quarterback know-how when we get into the league, or pardon me, like when these kids are getting into the league, is so good that, yeah, you can have that stellar defense in the back end to try and hold things down. But if you can't make these guys uncomfortable, it's just, you know, the quarterback play is just, it's so stellar that it's, you need something to be able to switch things up a little bit. You can't have, like, you just can't have Taylor Elgersma sitting back there all day long. You can't have Tristan Lefebvre. You can't have Keegan Hall. You can't have these guys just being able to read your defense with the time to be able to break things down, or they're going to get more wins on that side of things. Tom, when we look at, though, this running game, we can see some of the promise of maybe some of these young guys that we've seen some stuff on with these teams. But Amilcar Polk's year, it's kind of parallels. it kind of parallels the Max Carbonneau thing, like, to a T, when you look at how they had these guys fill in for these absolute transcendent talents at their respective positions. And we've talked about this with other teams too, where they just manage to backfill in these positions. And you just, even when a just top talent leaves, you're just like, hey, you have the trust that they will find that guy and that they'll be all right. And it's like, you know what? Maybe you haven't seen it yet, but you just know. And yeah, we can talk about this Charles Asselin. We can talk about the Suleiman Kamara and whomever else that they're going to bring in, because they recruit so well. Like, when you look at what Polk did this year, though, what stands out to you the most? Is it the fact that he did this on the back of J.P. Simmons-Kinda's year? Is it the fact that he was doing this with, again, Josh Jansen turned out to be a tremendous diamond in the rough, but whether Miracle helped give Simmons-Kinda the year he had, or Simmons-Kinda helped Miracle, like, you can see where those mm-hmm. two helped each other a little bit. Mm-hmm. With Polk, it was very much more, hey, look, this is our offense for a much larger expanse. What component of his incredible year was the most impressive for you?
Well, I think you just nailed it right there. It's not only the fact that Amilcar Polk is a phenomenal running back, and he is, you know, right up there with J.P. Simmons-Kinda, obviously, with the showcase that he was able to show here, but it's the fact that teams know that your starting quarterback is out, and in certain cases, your backup quarterback is out. And so you are going to have to lean on the run game. And even knowing that teams are going to come out, that this team is going to come out, and they're going to focus on running the ball, they still come out. Amilcar Polk, in seven games, because he got injured in the last one, in seven games finishes with 824 yards. And another little facet on top of that as well, he does not have a single fourth or fifth year offensive lineman blocking for him. Mm. The oldest O-linemen that are there are third years. Now, that O-line was great for them, don't get me wrong, but when you have a fourth or a fifth year guy, you've got that experience that's there, you've got whatever, you might have some additional know-how. Third year of eligibility, all of these guys, that's the oldest on that offensive line. So these guys, like, it's not like he has that the guys to lean on in those 50. And once again, I'm not I don't want to give any disrespect to that Ottawa GG's offensive line. They obviously did great for him, but I think once again that speaks to Amilcar Polk, and he's working with young guys up front and a team and an offense and a defense, sorry, on the other side that knows that they are going to be a run first team, and he still pulls out 824 rushing yards in seven games and seven touchdowns.
No, it's incredible. And just like how that kept them afloat in so many of these games. And like, you look at, you know, you have some of these scores where, you know, they're a bit lower scoring. And of course, when you have Campbell Fair, and we talked about this so much with, you know, going back to, with Laurier and just the off year that help me out. I'm spacing on the kicker there, and by the look you're giving, you're spacing on too. But when he started to, I want to say Nathan Mesher, I'm going a kicker a bit too far back in the archives for Laurier. But like, how that can affect just the way you call up plays when you know that you have such a tremendous asset at kicker. But like the ability for Polk to be able to just like grind them out first downs in those key situations when you might be having to flip the field otherwise, and they're chewing up more of the clock. And, you know, even you go back to that game that we saw against U of T, the 15-10 effort. And like, yes, an ugly game from what we saw from both these two clubs in the grand scheme of things. It feels odd, but hey, number one, there is a lot of evidence that there's some good things on that U of T defense. Number two, like the Ben Maracle injury had just happened. Harner goes down in that U of T game. So like in the Waterloo game, or Harner goes down U of T, Maracle's down in Waterloo. So they're dealing with all this adversity early in their season, and just the ability of really relying on Polk through the first half of the season. Of course, the first half of the season nets them 2-2 with the losses to Western and to Windsor. But like, it's not without a sense of identity that like we have things going on. There's one thing where it's one thing if a team suffers these types of injuries coming off of losing a potential MVP and a potential Presidents Trophy winner the year before, and you know, having this just amazing season that you do, then you get these injuries and say, hey, look, it's just not our year. I think that's one of the things that was most impressive, was that through all that and through how easily it could have been for them to just throw up their hands and say, you know, it's not our year. It's you know, hey, well, let's get healthy. Let's get back next year. They're so close to upsetting Queens in two games in a row at the end of the season. And I think so much that has to go to Polk, and just a guy where we probably didn't get to appreciate his career that much, spending so much of it backing up Simon Kinda. But golly, am I ever happy that we got to see him in that starting role, because it's an effort that he did that is an uncommon one, I think. Not to downplay his talent, but just with all these things going on around him, it was amazing.
It was absolutely amazing to see all of the hard work that he had and everything that he was putting into this program. It was just incredible. By the way, the kicker we couldn't remember is Dawson Hodge.
Sorry, Jack Moore.
Yeah. Hey, listen, we're prepping for Ottawa. We're prepping for Queens. We got some time before we get into Laurier. We won't forget him there. But yeah, absolutely. Like you said, it's not just the fact that, you know, Amilcar Polk gets his chance, he gets his opportunity, he does his thing, and really shows out and why he's a top running back in the OUA here. But like you said, overall, this team and their dynamic and their ability to just shake off the injuries, the other factors that they were dealing with was really outstanding. And you take a look at it, and you know, we had a chance to speak. Well, we're going to be speaking with a very special guest for the Queens Gaels. But when you're speaking and when you're looking at that program, and you see that Queens team and all of the potential that they have and how good they should be, and they're dealing with their own injuries and that. And then to go back-to-back, they lose 12-8, and then they lose 15-10. And you're looking at this team going like, you're going up against Queens. It's still Josh Jansen who is in there. And you don't have Amilcar Polk in that playoff game. And you still, with barely an offense, you still put up those kind of numbers, and you're still right there in there because that defense shows out for them and they do anything and everything that they can. It was really outstanding to kind of see the resiliency of this Ottawa GG's team this past year, because they really showed, man, they've got some versatility and they are able to really come together when they needed to.
Now, obviously, a lot of our conversation, or a good part of our conversation, has revolved around, you know, some of the key players that might be moving on or that were kind of iffy about with their status. And, you know, you brought this question up when we were talking to folks in Kingston at the Vanier, given their proximity to Quebec. And we've asked it now to Coach Corey Grant for Carleton. And I think we need to have a discussion in this capacity with Ottawa when it comes to the increased tuition now that is being levied on Anglophone speakers in Quebec schools. And Tom, I want to, you know, because the assumption we're working on is that if there are You know, players who are perhaps on the fence of whether they're going to go to a Quebec school, or maybe if they're going to stay in Ontario, that if they're having to now pay $8,000 extra, this could have like a major effect on the decision that they're making. And maybe I'm reading this wrong, or maybe kind of the way I want to approach this is sort of from a different sort of angle. But Tom, of the GG's roster, ballpark guess. How many players do you think are currently on the roster from Quebec?
Ooh. I do not have the GG roster up in front of me here, so I'm not scrolling through it by any means. With the proximity that they have to Quebec and the natural French speaking that is in the city of Ottawa, I would have to assume that they've got a good chunk of people from Quebec who are playing there. So on a team of roughly, let's say, 100 people, just give or take, I'll say 20 are from Quebec.
You know what? Great effort by you on that, but I'm counting 31.
Wow.
Now, I don't have the point of comparison with Carleton to see from that standpoint whether or not the French-speaking population and Quebec and whether it's French-speaking, all those things, but We've still yet to put our finger on just how impactful this is going to be. And at the end of the day, we probably just won't know until we get to next season or as we continue into the recruiting game and start to have a better sense of, well, so-and-so was on this team's radar. And of course, when it comes to the top players, you know, they're on everybody's radar, especially at this part of the province. But, you know, we've talked to a few coaches about this now, but it's just you and me here. Let's just wrap on in terms of the impact that we could perceive this having on a school like Ottawa, Carleton, Queens even being in the mix. And yeah, and with the amount of French presence they already have on their team, if that plays into their advantage.
I would have to assume so. The fact that they are now going to be able to offer these kids $7,000, $8,000 potentially less a year to play in Ottawa rather than play in Quebec, I think is going to be a massive motivating factor to keep kids here. The other side of things, and that, you know, if we really wanted to deep dive into it, we could, is I wonder how many kids from Ottawa don't finish up school there or try to go to CJEP before they go into the RSEQ. I don't imagine it's that many, but I'm sure it's some who are now maybe looking to go into the French-speaking schools a little bit more, but because they're still out of province, technically, are they now coming back instead? And are you now getting a few more CJEP offers instead from some folks who are playing there? Once again, I don't know the breakdown in terms of how many Ontario folks or people from out of conference play in the CJEP, but still, that's an option for you as well. But even if you just own the Ottawa area for football, Ottawa is another one of these hubs of football. You know, you think of the Ottawa Sooners and all the amazing stuff that they were able to do. Even Frontenac is, well, I guess Frontenac's a little bit more Kingston area, but still in that realm of football, Ottawa is another major hub. And so if you're able to own Ottawa without having the risk, or at least a very seriously reduced risk of people going to the RSEQ, I think that's a massive win for the GGs and for the Ravens here. And like Coach Corey Grant already detailed, Ottawa's pretty damn good at recruiting. Marcel Belfay is, Coach Belfay, I should say, is pretty good at recruiting folks back to his alma mater in these Ottawa GGs here. And they've got some pretty damn good players. As it's showcased in, as I just confirmed this, 7 GGs going off to the combine, 5 of which going to the five of which going to the regional at Waterloo, and Ben Maracle and Kevin Victome going to the invitational in Winnipeg.
Yeah, no, and it's once again, this is what we come to expect from this team year in, year out. I did a bit of counting just there. It comes in at 18 Quebec born players for Carleton in contrast to Ottawa's 31. But now that I'm really thinking about it, my mind is almost thinking, well, hold on a second. If there's perhaps more roster spots opened up on rosters in Quebec from previously out of province players, maybe that actually hurts Ottawa more if some of those if they're getting like a third of their roster from Quebec and all of a sudden Quebec teams are losing. It feels so tantalizing to play with this concept and to really think about what this is going to mean in the long term for these teams. But really, I don't think we'll really know until we get to see it live up and close. And even then, it's going to be a couple of years till it really makes sense of what's happening with all this. Tom, you know, I'm trying to think of like the last direction I want to go in with this team. I don't know if you have anything off the top of your head. I guess, you know, like without someone to kind of throw this at, you know, we've obviously talked about the impact of, or not the impact, but the significance of being able to have the Panda.
Mm-hmm.
As this game where you get to see, I mean, you know, the fact that some of these kids who are, you know, a year, less than a year out of high school, right, standing in front of 20,000 people, crowds storming the field, game-winning kicks on, you know, the local cable channel and this, that, and the third. And the fact that, you know, there's guys who will, like, tell you that, hey, we finished 4-4, but we won the Panda, so it's all good. Like, that's just, like, you know, it's gravy for us. When we look at just that growth of the league in general, when we think of this game as a template, does it almost, I almost wonder if it, like, we obviously talk so much about, like, oh, you just need one type of Panda a week, right? Does it almost, like, does it cloud the vision of, like, what the realistic expectation is that we need to get at in terms of, like, what the product could be? Or does it make sense to keep holding it to that standard to push towards, because clearly OUA can make that happen for at least one game a year. And as we've unfortunately seen, I don't mean one game a year tongue in cheek. It trumps the product that we get for the Yates Cup oftentimes too. Like it's almost a tough thing where it's like I love having it, but it's almost like that, it's great. I love it for the Ottawa region, but like that should be, at least the Yates Cup should be that. Like, I don't know what to make of it.
I am forever an optimist, and so I am going to say that is the standard. That is what the standard should be for the OUA going forward, and I think that we have the capabilities to get there. Obviously, that Panda game is only, what, it's like 10 years old since its resurgence, at least. Carlton came back in 2014. Maybe 2013, so maybe 11 years now. But still, like, from the get-go, that game was damn near packed. And it was massive crowds. And it's only considered, you know, to grow past that, even without CHCH kind of covering it from that regard. So I really think that that's the standard of what could be. Now, whatever it is, whatever Ottawa is doing up there, whether it's the GGs, the Carlton Ravens, or both, they're obviously hyping up this game and really making sure that it's a focal point for the Ottawa residents, and particularly the students. How about Waterloo and Laurier? You have a very similar scenario right there. Maybe it's because it's not in the nation's capital. Maybe it's because Waterloo typically has had some struggles a little bit, whatever. But like, that's another prime example. The Battle of Waterloo should have that kind of capability. I know I'm biased, but the Battle of Highway 6 between Guelph Griffins and my Mac Marauders, that should be a sold-out game every single time. Those games are always really competitive here. Obviously, you've got your Westerns and your Queens with how competitive those are. Like, there's so many different dialogues here in terms of rivalries over the years and great games overall that I think the Panda game should be the staple. We should be working to get to every game to that level rather than just being like, oh, that's a one-off, it's whatever else. What can we pull from that to bring to these games to really hype that up? I've played in a few of your homecomings at Griffin's, at Alumni Stadium in Guelph. That place gets rocking when it's full. So I know that the capability is there. I would just love to see it on more of a daily basis.
Definitely. And it, you know, you wonder, like, does it make sense? No, I was gonna say, like, I think we've talked about the idea of rivalry week, but then the coverage is just gonna cannibalize one another. And because that's the thing, is that we already do that. We already have York and Toronto are gonna play each other each year. We already have the Battle of Waterloo are gonna play each other each year. And like, it becomes tricky where then you say, okay, do we just put it in amber? Like Guelph and Mac, we need it once a year. It just, it's got to happen. And you say Queens and Western, it's got to happen once a year. And then you say Windsor, sorry, you're too far. You're just too far away. Like, you get the bye that week, and what have you. And I guess you spread out across the season and everything like that. I mean, yeah.
Well, man, what about once per week? You've got Mac versus Guelph as the focus for this week. You've got Western versus Queens as the focus for this week. You've got the Panda game. You've got the Battle of Waterloo. You've got the Red Blue Bowl. Like, you could spread those out with a little bit of coordination with the scheduling to make sure that you've got a focal point that's a rivalry game each and every single week here, and really dive into the history of the game and think, like, you could do this up so well. And especially with the Panda as a focal point, man, like, that's really where I'm hoping that this game can go.
Yeah. And, like, again, it's like such a great way to, like, market the city as a football culture, because of how thoroughly the city shows up for it. And it's obviously heavily driven by students, but I think it's in large part that, like, no other rivalry in U Sport, or pardon me, in OUA, I shouldn't speak for, I'm sure Montreal, Laval, it'd be fun to hear some of those stories of what the Carabin and the Rouge or think of one another. But at least in the OUA, there is no, and animosity kind of feels a little negative, but in the context of what we're talking about, I think it's a positive thing of just like the feelings that Ottawa GG and Carlton Ravens fans, pardon me, players have to one another. I don't think that's the same for York Lions and UFT Blues. I don't think that's the same for Mac and Guelph players. I don't think that's the same for Laurier and Waterloo guys. I mean, shoot, when we were talking to Adam McGuire and making that comparison, he was kind of saying that, like, you know, Waterloo and Laurier, they're kind of cool with each other. And frankly, I'm not cool with that. I want Laurier and Waterloo to hate each other a little bit more, as long as it's kept civil within the context of, like, you know, we're solving it on the field. Like, when it's all done, we'll shake it up and we'll be cool with one another. But yeah, I think ultimately you're right. Holding that as the template of, like, why shouldn't this be the standard? We do it once a year as is. Like, do you want to know the secret to it? Drive down to Ottawa, ask them what's up, and figure out a way to do it. Somehow we turn this on to a pod of, you know, kind of critiquing the OUA. But that's what we do. It wouldn't be an At the 55 pod without this moment here. Tom, obviously we've taken it a bit off the rails from going GG specific to kind of using that magnificent game that they play in once a year as a conversation piece about OUA football, broadly speaking. But last words to you on just what we saw from this Ottawa team, what we're seeing going into the future, and just where this team's at in general with our exit meeting.
Yeah, this team has... it's one of those, and like almost every team in the OUA, there's a ton of potential here because of the players that they have, because of the capabilities that we've seen from this coaching staff, and potential for some of the guys who might be returning. Does Ben Merrickle fully healthy? There's a lot of things that are happening there. I think one of the things that I'm most interested in seeing is the development of one Charles Asselin, because this past year, Amilcar Polk was the guy. There was no questioning that whatsoever. And Charles became something of a, almost for the NFL folks out there, almost like a Deebo Samuel, where he's kind of doing a bit of everything, where he's a bit of a wide receiver, he's a bit of a running back. They might swing him out to the side and whatever else. Now, presumably, maybe they have somebody, some other plans, but they want to keep him in there, whatever. But presumably, he is now the guy. He is now the running back, and you know for damn sure Ottawa wants to keep their dominance on the ground in some way, shape, or form, even if it's not to the extent of the domination that Amilcar Polk brought, but they still want to have that focus. So how does Charles Asselin develop into that potential number one running back? I don't think that he has the same style of running as an Amilcar Polk in that, you know, I don't know that he's going to be running anybody over kind of thing, but I still think from the brief sections that we saw, I liked his vision. I loved his quickness. I think he's got a real potential there, especially for like an outside zone stretch play where he's got gaps to work with and he can pick his spot and run, or like a power run game where he's got blockers out in front of him to open up a way for him. I'm really interested to see what they do with the run game, because regardless of who's quarterback, whether it's Ben Merrickle or Josh Jansen, you're going to need some kind of support there to keep the defense from just pinning their ears back and coming back after your quarterback, and hopefully, knock on wood, making sure that there's no more injuries to that quarterback room. But that's what I'm really interested in. What is that run game going to look like going into 2024?
That's a great call. And just picking up on that, you wonder to what extent they make him the sort of bell cow in the running game when he is, you know, you use the NFL comp, but he's a little Kasim Ferdinand-y. Like, Kasim's obviously more receiver, but just that kind of Swiss Army knife type player where, you know, Aslan obviously is so great as a returner, which speaks to just his vision, as you mentioned, his agility, his ability to evade tacklers and all that, that like, yeah, he might be able to excel as a power run player, but like, you almost wonder, like, does that handicap just quite the full extent of capabilities he brings to the table? So, I mean, it makes all the sense in the world. I think that's such a great point you lead to, because of course, just like the natural evolution of this running game from going from Simonkinda to Polk, and it's like, well, Aslan, you are the guy now. And Kamara had some nice moments last year as well, and who's there to run the ball, or probably hand the ball off to them or get them the ball in space in any capacity is, of course, as you mentioned, the biggest thing. With that defense being what it is, you know, it's it'll be a fun team to watch. So you know, yeah, it's I think, you know, Ottawa Gigi's fans, like myself, of course, leading the bandwagon, are nothing but optimistic looking forward to this year. And it'll certainly be an interesting one to see for sure. And just, I guess, last word I'll say is, like, you know, this team was 4-4. Look at Western. For all intents and purposes, no real reason to think that they're going to be falling off a cliff anytime soon. You have Laurier at 7-1. Mm-hmm. Same comment for them. I mean, we'll look through the roster, and definitely a couple of key players on that defense I can think of that might be gone next year, but same comment. Windsor, 6-2 this past year. Still going to be really strong. Queens, 5-3. They'll probably actually just get better. Queens is the team that I think we're talking of being like, oh my God, watch out for them. Carlton also at 4-4. Yeah, watch out for them. Oh, Laurier, 3-5. Yeah, watch out for them. Guelph, 3-5. Yeah, watch out for them. Then we get into Toronto and Mac, and you know what? Especially if Scott Brady, after all the conversations we have, is staying there, you know what? I can see it happen. They figure out some things in there with their coaching staff and everything like that. Scott Barnett for UFT, just take a moment, folks, and just thank your local OUA football team for just being so great, because the talent is immense. That, like, we have Ottawa at 4-4 this year, looking so positive, but like, it is just deadly all around them from the top to the bottom. Mm-hmm. With them being smack dab in the middle at 4-4, and you say, well, how high can you get? That ceiling is going, looks like it's so far away, yet the floor is getting closer and closer to you. So we'll see how it all pans out. I know I gave you kind of last words on Charles Aslan then, but any final closing remarks here as we turn the page on episode 7 of the exit meeting?
There's a lot of potential question marks here for this Ottawa GG's team about how are they going to bounce back? What are their injuries going to look like? Are their guys going to be 100% ready to go? The big three for me, I already talked about Charles Aslan, seeing his development, seeing how he goes. Just for context, Amilcar Polk is listed at 5'10", 200 pounds. Aslan, 5'11", 185. So that 15 pounds less, that amounts to a lot, especially when you're a running back. So to see him, what that quarterback situation is going to work out to be. Is Ben Maracle going to be the guy, or are they going to give Josh Jansen a look as the young kid, the up-and-comer? What's that going to look like? And then finally, what is your response for Max Carbonneau? Having him leave them from this program and graduate out, how are you going to try to replace him? Are you going to change up the defense like we were talking about potentially with James Peters leaving? Or are you going to find another stud? Is somebody else going to have a breakout game? So those are the three positions that I'm really concerned of, and three positions that I think you need to have, especially for this GG squad and how they're tooling up. You need to have that consistency there at all three. And how well those three positions play, I think, is going to be a direct result into how well this GG team does in 2024.
Well, one thing's for certain, whomever it is taking the field for that club, you know they're going to be coached up well with Coach Belfay at the helm. That'll be a wrap for episode 7 of the Exit Meeting series. Tom, do we tell them who our special guest is coming up on our next episode? Will we talk a little Queens Golden Gales football?
I think so.
Well, joining us for episode 8, you're not going to want to miss it, because joining us is the head coach for the Queens Golden Gales, Coach Steve Snyder. So join us then right here at the 55.